Weaver of Context, Caroline Casey. So first, heartful keening for those allies, known and unknown, whose homes are now ashes, and including all of our plant, animal, and bird relations. Friend of show John Rulak reports from Sonoma, it's a fire apocalypse. There are no resources, that we are not prepared as a species. The prison population that's been used to fight fires is decimated by COVID, and there is no water and planes overhead. So, whew. And also to everyone, to allies in Carmel, Big Sur, to Sonoma, Santa Cruz, and to last week's guest, Mary Greer, in Nevada City, all cooling mist. And to our friend of show, Sarah James, in the Gwich'in, in the Arctic, protecting still the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which they call the place where all life begins. And the NRDC bringing its lawsuit. There we go. And the Democratic Convention, many great stories. There are many stories all going on, but intimacy with so many. And Obama, dreeing his weird, what he is good, animating the soul of the country, addressing the danger, and calling forth the best in all of us. You know, potent magic, as we aspire to do now, this hour, and in perpetuity. So it is so perfect to host our wonderful guest today, cooling mists on the conflagration. As so much life is at risk, we welcome award-winning science journalist Judith D. Schwartz, whose latest book, The Reindeer Chronicles and Other Inspiring Stories of Working with Nature to Heal the Earth, proffers myriad heartening stories of devastation, devastating deserts that then can return to blooming, as can our hearts. So welcome, Judith.
Thank you.
And thank you. I am so, this book is so much a bomb, a B-A-L-M, to, as an antidote to the bomb, the OMB. It is completely so the way to go, and you are proffering so many stories and so much, so many heartening conferences that you're addressing and all over. And it is the book, The Reindeer Chronicles, contains so many great podcasts and references and conferences. People are doing good things. There we go. And just another thing, but before I hand it to you, I also want to thank you for your writing, in which you are painting with words so we can see this, you know. And your breadth is heartening, and it hums us. And I love where I sort of resonated also is gardens and Islam. And maybe can we start off with gardens and Islam and the idea of paradise? Our word paradise means enclosed garden.
Yeah, certainly. Wow, I haven't been called to start there, so I'll kind of move my, you know, bring my imagination to those stories. Yeah, so as you said, that this book is full of stories and insights from people who are dedicated to restoring our global ecosystems, place by place, landscape by landscape. And I just felt so strongly that these stories weren't being heard and how much we can learn from them, even from across the world. There are insights that apply to wherever we are. So there's one really interesting permaculture design teacher who I met, of all places, in Switzerland. And his name is Ramis Kent. He is an African-American who... Let's see. He became interested in Islamic studies in his 20s. Actually, I think when he was living in Berkeley. It was somewhere in the Bay Area. There's an institute that he became involved with. And so he became interested in Islamic poetry and traditions. And then he learned of the work of Jeffrey Lawton of Australia, who also became a Muslim and has been working in Jordan. And Jeff Lawton is known for this particular project, which is known around the world as Greening the Desert, the Greening the Desert Project. And it's an instance where this incredibly dry, saline earth, just nothing was going to grow there. Just how he worked with permaculture design principles, which aim to work with nature and via synergies of different plants working together and working with the wind and slowing down, capturing the water and all of this, and created this incredible food forest in this desert. So Ramis learned of this, and immediately, I mean, it just clicked. As Ramis said, it just pushed all his buttons. So he became a permaculture design teacher. And as he learned more about permaculture and working with plants and working with water and shaping landscapes, I know that he does a lot of work with earth moving to change the way that water flows on the land so that the plants are more productive and the water stays in the landscape, he became increasingly aware of how these weren't two separate aspects of his life, but rather it connected. As he looked into Islamic, just different passages from the Quran, that it referred to some of the work that he was doing about the importance of stewarding nature. And also when he was working in Yemen, you know, I'm so impressed. I have to say, I'm so impressed with people I meet who just think nothing of going into a war zone to help people to learn to grow their own food, to have more stability in their lives, and to revive their lives after disaster. So he was in Yemen, and he was trying to make a plan. He was working with villagers who had been flooded out, I think, around 2008. And people were still refugees, basically, even though they were within the same country. And he was trying to come up with a plan. And the next one day, someone came in and brought a book of Islamic poetry. And they read it together. And in essence, this book offered a kind of a roadmap for what they can do on this landscape in terms of all the different plants that are appropriate for that landscape, which different plants work together. And then as he continued to explore, he saw the original designs of the Greening the Desert Project and saw that that basically was enacting a passage in the Quran about how trees are planted, and then the water flows.
Right, and in the Quran, it's, yeah, all life comes from water. And that's really moving. And as Rami says, it had poems that talked about what used to be planted in the landscapes in that region. The poetry ends up being a sort of botanical survey or animal survey for a given place and a reference for a recreation of these systems. Poetry is very much tied to the history of the Arabs. We were able to go back and look at these poems as a way of informing something that they might possibly do in the present. And then you say that the notion of a productive, fully realized garden as emblematic of paradise is central to Islam. I guess that's Rami saying that.
Right.
And I love your definition. I'm sorry.
Oh, yes, that the notion of an oasis is a planned, water harvested area,
right,
with trees and different plants growing in harmony.
And you tie that to the Amazon, where you say also, you know, plants were planted 4,000 years ago intentionally, and we go, right, okay, looking backwards, and then the poetry, it's also because when you get to your chapter on Maui and restoring Hawaii, that the meetings open with a woman chanting a beautiful poem prayer and invoking goodness in all the speakers, and we love that to and fro, but a desert is a place where when it rains, it floods. So you have so much to say about that, you know, and certainly, and we're speaking, you know, with the devastation in California and so many places. So, you know, the runoff, right? So it was years ago, permaculture people said, you know, when I was saying, let's slow down to speed up, and they go, that's what permaculture is. The more you slow water down when you run it through a field with berms, you know, the faster it infiltrates. So, and you do say, you know, all of us can start where we are about slowing water, right?
Yes, absolutely. And it's important to understand that whenever we do something to the land, whether it's building on top of it, whether it's cutting down trees, whether it's plowing up a field, that is altering the way the water moves across the landscape. And depending on the degree of the intervention, also how it moves across the atmosphere, through the atmosphere, because that's a really important aspect of how water functions on the planet.
Right. And it is, you over and over stress again, it's the absorption. There's, you know, California, many, many permaculture people have been working on this, but this, here's again the conflagration, you know, and so much wiped out, and then a vision of how it might return. But that's why I was also so heartened by your reporting on your ally working in Yemen. You know, this idea of intimacy going Yemen, we think of it as, you know, horrible. But he goes into it is rocky, but there are fertile valleys and there's things to do here. And it, so it's like weaving intimacy. We have a friend of show who's been weaving us with intimacy to Syria, going, it's not just news, it's people and land and all of that that is so disrupted. And outside Damascus, well, we want to bring war into play, right? Outside Damascus, where I got to visit with my wonderful Syrian friends, there is a Darma Musa. It's a, I think, 6th century Christian monastery that's being repurposed as a place of Christian and Islamic environmental work. We go, interrupted by the war. So, yeah, but, then I love, yes?
Oh, I was just going to say that, you know, with just, it's so disheartening to hear and to know about all the fires that are going on right now, you know, but what can we do? We all must go forward and certainly learn from the fires, learn how to manage the fires, and certainly the people that I've worked with have much to say about that. But I remember one permaculture designer, Andrew Millison, saying how encouraging it is that some of the most extraordinary and successful eco-restoration projects are in the most devastated landscapes. So that is a clue to us that we can do this, and it's a matter of our intention.
Right, and tradition and storytelling, as you do so well in this really, really great book, The Reindeer Chronicles by Judith D. Schwartz, our guest for today, because you travel all over, and when you get to Norway, and I know one of your passions is about grazing animals, that what we think is, or what the Dementors of Doom think is a problem is actually, no, if we study that, no, as long as you have animals moving, and you tie the connection to fire and your Norwegian allies working on that, which is that the reindeer, you know, trample down the shrubs, which would dry into fire tinder. And you say the reindeer, which the government wanted to slaughter, keep it cooler. They keep the north cooler. Do you want to guide us
right
into that?
So the reindeer story, that wasn't about fire. I can get to the fire later, but certainly the polar regions are warming faster than any other parts of the planet. So we want to keep those regions cool. And despite the Norwegian government saying that too many reindeer is a threat to the fragile tundra ecosystem, the truth is that the reindeer, as they are managed by the Sami people, the indigenous communities, actually keep the landscapes cool. So what it is that in the summer grazing, because the land is, that those regions are warming, there are more shrubs and bushes and small trees growing, but the reindeer browse them. They eat the leaves and they keep those larger plants managed. And one reason that's important is because of the principle of albedo. So that means reflectivity. So snow or the very light colored heat in the region reflects heat. So the ground isn't absorbing that heat. However, those plants, the trees and shrubs, have dark leaves. So those, not only are they growing because of the warming, but if they grow, they perpetuate the warming because their green, dark green leaves are absorbing heat. So that's one way that the reindeers help. Another is that in the winter grazing, winter into spring grazing, and they're on snow, they are pressing, so they move in huge herds. When they are pressing down on the snowpack, that actually maintains the permafrost because the snow was insulating the soil. So it keeps the ground cooler. There's a father and son team of scientists that have a project in Russia called, in Siberia, called Pleistocene Park. The term Pleistocene referring to the large animals that, like saber, this and that, the mammoth, all of those creatures that we lost in the Pleistocene many, many, you know, thousands of years ago. And they want to bring back their modern day analogs. So they studied the impact of grazing on snow and movement on snow, and they found that it was something insane, something like 30 degrees Celsius difference cooler when the land was grazed, because they were pressing down, they were trying to get in, the reindeer were trying to, or whatever, but the reindeer are trying to get at the lichen. I'm not exactly sure the behavior of the other animals, but mainly the pressing down of the snowpack. So that's really pretty extraordinary. And about the, with fire, a lot of, so the example that I had, but I know lots of people in California working on this. I guess one way to understand it is that, so, you know, think about nature before there were humans. Just let's pretend humans aren't around. And so we have vegetation growing. Vegetation is managed by plant-eating animals, by herbivores. Okay, so that's how the plants were managed, so that they didn't just dry out or die and become fire tinder. I mean, obviously fires did occur, but this was in a managed, everything was in its own kind of equilibrium. It's a cycle that was in balance. So those plant-eating animals, in turn, were managed by predators. So predators would keep these animals, the herbivores, moving. And that's how the system maintained itself. So we have people, and certainly people lived in harmony with wildlife for a long time. Then we have people, modern people, who are building roads, building parking lots, building houses, housing developments, and cities. And this has disrupted the predator-prey dynamic because, you know, like there's a road in the way. So that's really altered that scenario. Okay, so that's the basic scenario. So in Australia, which, as you know, I'm sure your listeners are aware that that's another place that is very, very vulnerable to fire. So there is a farmer there who manages a tract of land the size of the five boroughs of New York. His product is restored land. That is his intention. And he works with cattle, because the cattle are the way that if he manages them appropriately, they are eating the brush. They are eating we think the cattle only graze, but they also browse to some extent. So they are enhancing the quality of the soil and the soil's ability to hold onto water. And that in itself minimizes fire risk, because you've got more moisture in the system. But also he brings them to where they can also browse. Now, there are areas that cattle don't like to browse. You know, they don't want to go like in nooks and crannies. As it turns out, this region of Australia, Western Australia, has a huge population of wild donkeys.
Hey, donkey, I love the donkey story.
In the 1800s, when Australia was being explored and developed by white people, they were pack animals. They were brought to Australia to work. One thing about donkeys is that they live a long time, upwards of 40 years often. So by the time, so over that period of time, trucks and, you know, just mechanized transit was brought in, and the donkeys weren't needed anymore, or maybe some people moved or some people died. And so there ended up to be these bands of wild donkeys running around, and the government sees them as a pest. However, Chris Hengler, the farmer I'm talking about, sees them as fire managers, because they are browsing the vegetation, which otherwise might have dried out and become fire tinder. So there's real tension there, because he's trying to do scientific research to make the case for the wild donkeys, whereas the government keeps saying that they're pests and we want to exterminate them. Right now, they are at a standstill. So the donkeys are still there, and they're still doing their work. So the animals on the land are important for fire, because they're managing the vegetation, also because they are restoring the soil. And in restoring the soil, they're restoring the water cycle, because when you have soil that is rich in organic matter, which most of which is carbon, then that land can hold so much more water. And that's important for so many reasons. Having more moisture in the landscape, having more streams and smaller bodies of water that serve as fire breaks, and providing more moisture for the growth of more trees. And also because, where was I going with this? They're also important because they're, By keeping moisture in the land, in the soil, they're able to, the activities of the animals on the land, it extends the season of green growth. So California is a place where there tends to be, now I know it hasn't quite been like this of late, tends to be a drier season and a season when there's rain. So it's really helpful for fire management to keep the green growing season, which is more resilient to fire, to have that go as long as possible, if that makes any sense. Because then, everything's green and growing and more resistant to fire.
Right. And we come back to the predator-prey, and you do resonate in your book, The Reindeer Chronicles, you know, that you begin wonderfully, you know, the wedding of science and soul and heart, you know, and a collaborative curiosity and a well-wishing, and this dynamic of predator-prey, because throughout the book you address the predator corporation or government versus the indigenous in that sense, you say pray. And we go, this is interesting. You know, many of us have seen, of course, the wonderful George Monbiot short film on wolves and Yellowstone, and how the absence of wolves, once they introduced wolves, kept the deer in check, and then birds came back, and things began, and the rivers had their shores again. Yeah, so the human heart relating to predator not being the only predator, right? I mean, I don't know. I mean, have you mused on this, that for lack of actual predators, humans in their sort of dementor form have become the disrespectful, the non-contributing predator?
Right. But, so we are sort of the default predator for these animals, in meaning that we need to keep them on the move, but you're right that we take it way too far. If we were a predator invested in maintaining the integrity of the system, that's one thing. And that is what animal predators do. You know, not consciously the way that we have conscious behavior, but yes, we go too far. And that brings up what's very interesting in what you're saying, and I want to clarify this for listeners, is that you're connecting the predator-prey culture and the predator-prey animals, and I had not made that connection before. So just to explain the predator-prey culture, in Norway, I took part in a symposium on indigenous wisdom, indigenous knowledge. And I spoke about the global ecology of grazing. And there was a talk there that just had me stunned. It was by a fellow named Andi Sombi, who is an indigenous Sami scholar. He teaches in the northernmost university in the world, Tromso. And he teaches indigenous law. And his talk was brilliant and kind of, you know, just hard to take because it was so raw.
Right. Did you want to continue there?
Do you want to mention your what you got out of that?
No. I didn't want to trample on top of your pause. Do continue.
Okay. So, Sombi begins his talk about the Aesop's tale of the wolf and the lamb, and the wolf accuses the lamb of muddying up the water, of insulting him, of all of these things, and then, I guess, eats the lamb. Now, Sombi asked the question, well, the wolf could have done whatever he wanted to the lamb. Why did he have to accuse the lamb of these atrocities? And the answer was that a tyrant wants to justify his own tyranny. And then he took it further and talked about, it was very interesting how he did this because he didn't make it too blatant, but you could see where he was going. He was talking about the Sami people who had their traditions and cultures and just different ways of living. And then this Western Norwegian culture sees that the land that the Sami live on, you know, which had been seen as kind of wasteland, just, that's way up north, it's all snow, but there are minerals there, there's hydro energy there, I think there's oil and gas there,
copper mines,
fishing there.
Yeah.
So that's when the predatory nature of a seemingly benign nation like Norway starts to kick in.
Right. We're going to take a very short pause because this is deeply rich. Our guest today on the Visionary Activist Show is Judith D. Schwartz. Her latest book, and I want to read all of your books on grazing and water, whose latest book is The Reindeer Chronicles and Other Inspiring Stories of Working with Nature to Heal the Earth. And we will be right back after this very short break.
She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She showered his head with quasars and made his tortoise cry.
Oh, get down.
Chiny, 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 come blow my chiny home. Chiny, chiny, come blow my chiny home. Telegraph my indigo skyship, make its voyage long.
Now get down.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. It will be 24 years the first week of September, and thank you, Taj Mahal, for supplying our break music. Our perfect for now and forever, really, guest today is Judith D. Schwartz. Her latest book, The Reindeer Chronicles, and Other Inspiring Stories of Working with Nature to Heal the Earth. Right, again, she paints with words how we can address the horror, but also look what we could do, look what we could do. So many forms of bioremediation and so many good people working on that. And so the predator prey, know what you were addressing right before break. It's like the Balinese say, you know, the Dutch were more honest when they arrived and said, we've come to steal your resources. And they said, the British came and said, no, we've come to improve your civilization while we steal your resources. And it's like, no, that was naked there. I remember hearing scientists lamenting the loss of the polar bears and thinking there's very little future. And he said, you know, what we're losing is one of the most curious intelligences on our Earth, because these large predators are confident enough to, you know, there's the famous photograph of the Russian submarine surfacing and the polar bear strolling over going, yeah, who the hell are you? What's up? You know, and so he grieves the loss of this confident curiosity, you know, and we go, all right, okay. So back to Norway for a time, but you do take us all over. And yeah, the conference that you were at, Indigenous Knowledge, the Practice of Sustainable Existence. And, you know, over and over, I think in what you report, a wonderful phrase, you know, that wildlife anchors identity. And this is so important to the Sami. I'll toss it back to you, and then to our allies, the Gwich'in, in the Arctic, you know, just in Arctic Circle, Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, that the Gwich'in call the place where all life begins. And they say we are inextricably intertwined with the caribou. You know, it anchors our identity. And then just one other little thread. You know, you also delineate, I can't remember if it's Mali, where they build the dam without understanding, so the downstream people have no fish, so they begin to eat the rare birds that actually have gone to the Arctic and their long and arduous journey. And it's like, oh, no. Okay, all right. So maybe wherever you want to go is fine, but but I love also, just back to this slowness of pace in Norway, you say they have slow TV, they binge watch knitting, and they binge watch the reindeer migration. And that's your ally, the Sami, Josette Antes, excuse my pronunciation, his lawsuit against the government, and his artist sister, Marit Saris, who did the Pile of Bones, right, which is resonant to, you know, Native Americans as well. You tell us what she did as a, just look at this horror, just acknowledge this horror.
Yeah, so when I was in Norway, there was a case going on of a young reindeer herder named Josette now I'm remembering, now I'm forgetting, Ante Sara.
Yeah.
He was only about 23 at the time. So as I was saying, the Norwegian government said there are too many reindeer. So herders need to cull a percentage of their animals. And this young herder said no and felt very strongly that so young reindeer herders only had a few, they were just starting. They did not have huge numbers of animals. They only had a small number. So a percentage loss would kind of push them over the margin. So it would destroy this tradition. So he said no, and he took the government to court. And this became a really big news case in Norway. And part of it was he was just this confident young man, and he wore traditional Sami clothes when he was on the TV or, you know, being interviewed. And also because his sister is an internationally known conceptual artist. And so she got involved with this and created this kind of multifaceted art installation called Pile of Sapmi. So it's like pile of bones. Sapmi is the land that the Sami live on. And 200 reindeer heads, reindeer skulls, piled. And that certainly makes a statement. Then she did another one that was, she strung up 400 reindeer skulls on wire that made a kind of curtain. So it's, from a distance, it's very beautiful. You can't see what it is. I mean, up close or in the pictures that I've seen, it's very beautiful, but in a very dark way. And that, she brought that to the national court when her brother's case was being decided. And unfortunately, this was months after I was there. This was at the very end of 2017, after the government kept appealing, the young herder lost. So I've been in touch with Marit Ahn since then, and she said that basically they gave the animals to their mother, so the animals per se are still alive, but they aren't able to work the land the way that they had hoped to. And talk about ironies, you mentioned the slow TV in Norway, which is that phenomenon. People had no idea that when they were watching the majestic herd of reindeer move across the landscape, that some of those reindeer were the ones that were at issue in this case. So, you know, just, I just feel layers of irony that people are saying, oh, we have such beautiful animals in our country. And then, you know, those are the animals that, you know, that's part of what was at stake, basically. And yeah, so there's a lot of misunderstanding about how animals function on land, which I focus on that a lot because I think it's so important on many levels. One is because there are many cultures, indigenous cultures, that do have very strong relationships with animals, with other creatures that are misunderstood and often frowned upon. I know that in Norway and in Sweden that there is a disconnect between the Sami community and the people further south, that there's a lot of, again, misunderstanding, suspicion. It's like, are these people real? Can we trust them? Are they dirty? Are they ignorant? So, yeah, I mean, this happens the world over. And also the same is true there are pastoral herders in Africa that I know of, and you know, they're under a lot of threats too. So that's one reason. And also because so much of the globe is really in nature managed by animals, but we don't see it. It's invisible to us. We see land that we could do something with, potentially, and animals that happen to be on there. We don't see the ongoing relationships. And I think that seeing that helps us understand landscapes and wetlands and other ecosystems. And through understanding, that would give us tremendous insight as to how to live in them in greater harmony.
Right. And extending, you know, vocabulary, it's like anything we have a name for, we have a relationship. And, you know, there's so much in the breadth of your book. The Reindeer Chronicles, really, I have unbounded enthusiasm for this. I want everyone to get a copy and put it in your library as well. But I was lucky enough to be invited by my brother-in-law when he won a Nobel Prize. Want to come with us? I'm like, oh yes. And the dinner in Stockholm, where they served, you know, smoked reindeer with lingonberry sauce, right? And then I said to my Swedish, what do you love about Sweden? He goes, ah, I love the melancholy of the north. That's where the soul of the country is, right? So it does resonate again, you know, and you're speaking to it in this book, in this wonderful wedding, kind of in the tradition of Lauren Isley, you know, science with a soul and with poetry, which you weave so well together. And then I think a crucial thing for our whole team, there's so much here. You know, there's a plethora throughout your book of people doing great things. Podcasts, conferences, projects. I think this book is a great departure point. I want to check out everything that you reference, really, you know. And then the crucial part of strategy is that when you're in New Mexico and there's so much conflict, I think it's one of your allies who says a community that's lost its way, and that you felt that knowledge was not enough. But in then a group that I guess then you're convening in Mexico, acknowledging fear, like, and then the question for everyone, what would be the best possible outcome? And you did a beautiful thing, you know, which is, you know, if it were possible, right, to the liberation of imagination. And so many great environmental, you know, allies and scientists and teammates of yourself and all of us, all life really, say, yeah, to critique and then to imagine. It's like the, you know, in everything, it's we have a magic mirror. The mirror holds up and reflects, going, oh my God, it's really terrible. And then with a wave of our paw, you know, we turn mirror into window, but look how beautiful it could be and has been. Look at that, you know. And then with another wave of the paw, door, let's go. Which your book really, really does. Let's go. So what would be the best possible outcome? Is that something that you keep in your heart there?
Yes, that was a really pivotal experience. So I happened to be in Mexico at a gathering, and I don't know, I mean, this isn't a moment when we're having these gatherings in person, but, you know, when you're writing about things and you're involved in activist communities, you may get together, and then there's kind of a pattern, there's a lot of talks, and then you get together. But I was feeling, usually that really energizes me, but at that particular point, I was feeling, all right, I've heard these talks before. When are we going to actually get anywhere? And at that moment, and then because what was hitting me was that, well, I know it's obvious to many people, but it didn't truly hit me until then, was that as a journalist, it's all about conveying knowledge. And I finally, you know, realized that, you know what, that's not enough, that there's something human, something in us that's resistant to change, sometimes resistant to seeing what is in front of us, sometimes forgetting what we know to be possible, all of these human attributes. And so I was just spinning in that and feeling kind of lost. And then I encountered this fellow named Jeff Goebel, who I had learned about from colleagues, and the way that they always described his program of the consensus model when you're talking and you're sharing and this and that, and you sit around in a circle. Well, I'm a very restless person. So I was thinking, I'm sure that's a really great idea, but I'm not interested. So anyway, I met him. He was at this conference, and I said, well, I want to know what you do. And then we had this little group, and then I saw it in process for a 3-day workshop in New Mexico, when I truly watched a community transform from literally, I mean, this is the Wild West, people shooting each other, people afraid to bring their children to their land, people sabotaging each other, fighting over the pump house. It was almost cartoonish. It was so bad. And moving from that state to a point where they wanted to work together to improve the land. And that has gone, that and that desire and actions towards making that happen have endured. So speaking kind of around this, so let me just clarify just a second. So the way that this particular consensus model works, it's about deep listening, conscious, respectful listening to other people, and trust. So some of it you work to build trust, but the core questions that are passed around the circle are, what is the situation and how do you perceive it? And that can be revelatory, because often people who are sitting in the same room experiencing the same things may perceive things very differently, and it can be really, you know, really informative to see how someone else that you've been dealing with truly experiences something. So what is the worst possible outcome? And the reason that that is used is, you know, because that's all what we want to avoid, because we're holding on to fear about what the worst outcome could be. And so we're defended against that fear, and a lot of our energy goes towards kind of managing it so it doesn't bubble up. And once you articulate the fear, you're kind of, and feel that you've been heard, well, there's kind of a liberation there. Then you move to what's the best possible outcome. And then, because you're no longer guarding against all the bad possibilities, all of your fears, you're liberated. And as Jeff Goebel says, once you have, and then, after what's the best possible outcome, what might it look like to get there? And once you come up with one idea, you're on the path. You've already broken that paralysis that fear sometimes keeps you in. And you get this energetic shift. And I will just say one thing, that Jeff is offering workshops, like free workshops, as an introduction to this method, because he feels so strongly that this is, because he's someone who's also studied land use a lot for many, many, many years. He feels that this is a really powerful tool for helping people to get to a place where they can manage and restore their landscapes. So that's on my website. There's a little link on the recent news, judithdschwartz.com. Just, I want to invite people to do that. So, definitely. Yeah, that was the process that we went through in New Mexico. And the shift was quite amazing. And all the people with the Bureau of Land Management who had completely, this was a last ditch effort for them. They were tired of having to go to this community several times a week to stop arguments, to worry about who's shooting, who's going to start a fight with who. And they were absolutely stunned by how things shifted.
That's great. Right. Story, frame, poetry, knowledge, all of that. I love the late, great Reuben Snake in a wonderful documentary about him, Your Humble Serpent. But he just says, here's a little bit of Native American wisdom for you. If we don't change our direction, we're likely to end up where we're headed. Right? Which is, it's a good way to open. There we go. So do you like that? And then in that same way, we keep these treasures, you know, working with Neil Douglas Klotz at a conference in Maine, and there were many Palestinian poets and people in the Israeli army and Jews for Peace and everything, and they all wanted to, maybe 200 people, to talk about the problems in the Middle East. And excuse me, Neil said, no, these people are not ready for this. They're not there. And I said, well, we're just going to create a frame that whatever somebody says, rah, 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 terrible thing, they are encouraged and responsible for a blessing that addresses that. You know, and it was, at first people didn't know what a blessing was. And then I said, it doesn't have to be realistic, you know, when American people are so stupid, you know, and your blessing would be, and it's like, oh, okay, may a pack of wolves, you know, whenever people hear lies, take them out into the woods. But what afterwards, and then people kind of got into it, and some even maybe more realistic blessings. But Neil said that was amazing because there was no poison in the room. Because everyone was responsible for a liberating vision of the problem that they'd brought up. And it's much like what you're talking about, Jeff's workshops. And we go, right, because it's what you're speaking about is the metaphoric conflagration of polarity. Rah, 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 and no, we're going to kill the coyotes or another thing. And how shall we, like nature, spirals resolve conflict in nature? So you're doing so beautifully well that way. So what would be the best possible outcome? And then just briefly back, you know, you speak early in the book that's important, and we've addressed it a little bit, the power differential between wealthy industrial government and indigenous, the predator-prey culture, and we are in this riptide. And then you speak of the language, what I would say, language bamboozling, right? And that's how the Norwegian government says, no, welcome the copper mine. It's very wonderful for you. It's very good, you know. And so do you have teammates and also yourself who address this, who liberate us from bamboozling language and hoodwinking? Is that part of your dedication?
I mean, I'm certainly interested in that, but I guess mostly through the consensus work, but it's important to really see what the language is, and that's what Ande Sambe's talk really articulated so beautifully, because it can be so easy just to kind of slip along with it. So he talked about a couple of the strategies that you were mentioning, the happy family strategy. We're all Norwegian. And developing this land so that we all can enjoy the bounty of the mineral wealth of this country. That's good for our happy family. Oh, you don't want this because you want to herd reindeer? Oh, well, that's what you want, but that's not good for our family. Things like that. Yeah, it's just really important just to see and not, yeah, to avoid being swept up in that as much as possible. But
right,
and no, the poor have not been there.
Yeah, and to be imprisoned in someone else's dedication. It's like story, who's got the story. Like the Bill Gates Foundation and the GMO people, they go, if you are against GMOs, you want to starve Africa. It's like, oh, and so what I encourage our informed team to do is step in and go, absolutely, we are united in our desire to feed all beings in an equitable fashion. We agree. Now we're going to back out. And did you know? There we go. There's so much in your book, again, as we're beginning to draw to a close, but you talk about compassionate conservatism, and you mentioned rewilding, and again, just but part of the real need for predators. I'm sorry.
Compassionate conservation. I know, conservatism is like...
Yes, what happened to me? What happened to me? Help, my mind was taken over. Thank you.
Exactly. We got you.
That was close.
I thought that was really interesting. I learned from a biologist in Australia who's originally from Israel, who brought up points that I must be honest, I had never thought about. And that is, who decides what is natural? Who decides, like, where? So for her example is, so Australia, the way that everyone thinks that Australia is and should be was determined by what it looked like when white people landed on its shores. So environmental author Emma Maris calls it the white dude moment. So, you know, but who are we to say? So that landscape where that is what Australia then is supposed, Australia, nature and Australia is supposed to be, does not include wild donkeys. So what this woman, Ariane Wallach, is saying is, let's look at the animals that are here. Let's approach conservation not from a standpoint of this is the ideal. Let's destroy, you know, animals that don't fit our ideal or not work to help their habitat or really study them. She talks about the wild donkeys as invisible megafauna because we don't think that they're supposed to be there. So we, and by we, that means the government, farmers, and ecologists, biologists, don't even see them. Our curiosity is turned off, is switched off, because it's not part of our vision of what the land should be. So One thing that is really positive is that some people are starting to expand their understanding of what nature should be. So, for example, having beavers on the landscape, I mean, that's huge in terms of keeping water on the land. And in Northern California, maybe even down to Southern California, I forget how far that they went, but a lot of fire country beaver were keeping water in the landscape. So
We are drawing all too soon to a close, but I really encourage everyone to find the Reindeer Chronicles and other inspiring stories of working with nature to heal the earth. It is absolutely part of the whole way to go. Live this story in every way. And thank you so much for your dedicated work, Judith Schwartz. And in perpetuity, it's very Antonio Machado. What have we done with the garden entrusted to us? And we feel that response that infuses your work. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
And thanks to Kirsten Thomas, wonderful board op, and to the whole team. And we will reconvene next week. And cool mists to all beings. Cool mists to all beings. Thank you so much. Woof, woof, woof.